Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
And still have, like, does people have so much potential that when you put down drink for a period of time that you can blossom then, you know?
Well, I just got a flash there. I'll share it with you.
Go on.
You know, people talk about life beyond your wildest dreams.
Yeah.
And some people think that's a terrible cliche and everything, that's corny. But I realised I was about 2 years in recovery. I was in Dingle Bay at 6 o'clock in the morning with my two sons. And Fungi came up with a salmon in his mouth to show it to us.
No way.
And I'm out in the bay in a wetsuit, isn't it?
Yeah.
And with two sons, and they're only kids at the time. And I said, this is a life beyond my wildest dreams. And what a magical moment that was.
That memory wouldn't exist if you were on the drink.
Absolutely.
But it's the actually be able to appreciate it. Something. Because you're actually aware there's nothing in control of your head. Like when we're drinking, the only thing thoughts we have is drink.
Yeah.
More drink. Where am I going to get more drink? But when you're in recovery, you can actually see beauty for what it is. You can see the ocean for what it is, the trees, the leaves. It's beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, and that's what, like, if anybody's ever asking me, you know, how am I ever going to enjoy myself again if I go up to drink? You see, it's something you learn. You know, beauty will start coming into your life that you never, ever, ever knew.
Like, peace of mind. And
I remember when I was drinking and drugging, and say, for example, I went to the walk. And I was next to a fellow who wasn't drinking, normal chap or whatever. He turned around and said, Jesus, isn't this beautiful? I'd say, yeah, it's grand, it's beautiful, you know, but I wasn't really saying, I wasn't telling the truth.
Yeah.
But today, when I see something that's beautiful, like I'd say it's absolutely beautiful because I can appreciate it, you know.
You have a first affinity with Cork. You have a first connection with Cork. You have a lot of Cork songs or songs by Cork artists. What's your first Cork memory? Or what's the first Cork gig you did?
Oh, God. The first gig I did in Cork was with Planxty in the City Hall in 1972. And a lot of us think that was the night that Planxty took off. We were playing support to Donovan. And we just took off that night.
Yeah.
But then I came back. That would have been 72. 1978, I was solo again. And the late Kenny Lee gave me my first solo gig in Cork. And that was the start of it. And then I started connecting with people. There's a great guitar player in Ballyfahan called Naishe Comerford. And I did a bit of playing with Naishe Comerford and Jimmy Crowley. And then I met Declan Sinnott and, you know, John Spillane and Ricky Lynch. And the great songs came my way from Cork, you know. I first heard Jimmy McCarthy in 1979 in the meeting place in Dublin. He was in a band called Southpaw. And that's the first time I heard him singing Right On.
Mm.
And a couple of years later, I asked him, would it be okay for me to sing Right On? And then all his other songs, The Contender, Bright Blue Rose, Missing You. Then John Spillane comes on the scene and it's John's songs. I think John is the greatest songwriter of my lifetime.
Really?
Yeah. Of the songs I've encountered, John has such beauty in a song like Gerta Toggart.
That's a beautiful song. Oh, you sang that at the Opera House.
It's just a gorgeous song.
I actually started getting very emotional listening to that song because it was bringing back into his childhood and he was talking about how it was in the countryside.
It sounded lovely too.
The place is called Gerta Toggart and I had the privilege of visiting his Auntie Mary's farm out near Bantry and he took me around all the places that are mentioned in the song.
Mm.
But now when I sing this song, I don't think of Gerta Toggart. I think of my own father's home place.
Lovely.
All the fields and the haggard and the hay shed and the bog and, you know, so John is beautiful.
He is. Yeah.
And when did you get the idea to? So you wrote a song about your connection to Cork and why you like Cork. Or when did the idea for that song come?
Myself and Mick were driving down. I've played the Marquee every year since it started.
Mm.
I think 17 years. And we're driving down this year. I said, Jesus, Mick, it'd be great to write an old song about the Marquee. And I started writing it on the way down. And I thought I'd do it that night. But I did it at the sound check and it was terrible.
So you wrote it within the car driving the
way down? I started it.
Oh, yeah.
And then when I was doing the gig in the Opera House for Don and the Cork Life Centre,
yeah.
I said, Jesus, I'll have to have a go at this song.
Yeah.
So I spent a few weeks at it and I did it that night and I haven't done it since, but I've been working on it.
Yeah.
That night was great.
Want to give it a blast, no?
Yeah, it was through your podcast that I met Don, you know.
Yeah, actually, do you want to tell us the story? Sing the song first, and we'll tell the Don story afterwards, the Portlaoise connection.
Saturday night, packed and tied, all together in the big marquee. The Cork Examiner says to me, why do you keep coming back? Year after year, the answer's plain and simple, Mick. The reason's very clear. It's the reels in Ringaskiddy and the jigs in Haulbowline. Ricky Lynch in the corner house, he's like a vintage wine. Oh, come on, Christy. Smarten up there. He's like a vintage wine. It's the crack and shark in Ireland and the hake in Union Hall and the turbot caught upon Cape Clear. You can eat the bones and all. On the banks, the beautiful banks on the banks of the River Lee. Saturday night we're packed and tied all together in the big marquee. Puccini's in the Opera House, Karl Marx in the Conley Hall, Joe Max in the Arcadia, the two Norries are on the ball. Maggie Barry's on the call, Kid Jimmy Crowley's on the rantantan, sound as a bell, Hank Waddell and the maestro John Spillan. Here's Katrina Toomey, she's coming up the mall to cook the penny dinner, to feed the great and small. And there goes Don O'Leary on the road to Sunday's Well, up to the Cork Life Centre for to ring the morning bell. On the banks, the beautiful banks, on the banks of the River Lee. Saturday night we're packed and tied all together on the big marquee. I took a wrong turn at Dunkettle, upon my soul, down the Jack Lynch Tunnel, woke up in the Metropole, and all along McCurtain Street till I came to Patrick's Hill. Big Noel said, keep coming back, and by God, I surely will. Back to the English Market, back to that scene, where a well-known Cork fishmonger met Her Majesty the Queen. He brought the cockles and the mussels, caviar and lobster tail. The periwinkle drove the poor old queen completely off the rails. On the banks, the beautiful banks, on the banks of the River Lee. Saturday night we're packed and tied all together in the big marquee. Oh, the lonely woods of Upton, the boys of Fair Hill, the piper of Crossbarry, I hear him still. I see the blood and bandage when I hear the rebels sing. I'm going to kiss that Blarney stone when the bells of Shandon ring. On the banks, the beautiful banks, on the banks of the River Lee. Saturday night we're packed and tied all together on the big marquee.
Didn't hear Tom that was driving, but they heard the lads and they were calling everybody's name. And then if they couldn't see somebody, they'd cycle away and they'd come back. I have him, I found him. And then there would be a sigh of relief from everybody because everybody wanted to make sure, all the lads that were on the bikes wanted to make sure that everybody came through this. And that was just a remarkable thing to see, the way that they worked so hard to make sure that that everybody was seen to. and they'd ask, did you see such a person, if they couldn't find them. But to see them peddling away like mad, and they covered some serious ground on the bikes, and we just hit every place. But again, the lads, it brought them to a whole new place for themselves as well, when they were being of service. And I suppose a basic fundamental thing for anybody to have inside them is to be allowed to be of service to somebody. And the lads were given that freedom, and we didn't have to do anything, only drive around with the food. They took care of the whole lot of it. But the camaraderie, they knew everybody's name, and they knew where everybody was, used, you know, would sit or hide out or something like that. But they would know how to get to everybody very quickly. And they'd come back and they'd say, you better come down here and have a look at him, see, is he all right? They were very caring in the whole lot of it. And I saw that when we have our new warehouse, I was saying, you know, I'd love the lads to be trained in as first responders, because I saw such a great deal in them. And it was, I suppose, a privilege for me to see the lads just doing so well at this, and what they were capable of doing. And when they found that their strength, you know, that they had to rely on each other to do this, and that they didn't have to come back to me to say, is it all right if I do this, or all right if I do that, I just said, do it. And they went off and they did it. And just to see that, and to see how much they grew, was just truly remarkable.
Do you know the lads know that you're on about, just to let our viewers know, the lads that were driving these mountain bikes were people that were homeless themselves, had addiction problems, mental health problems, but we're all in recovery, you know, and they were doing well through connecting with Penny Dinners. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
They were the lads from the recovery group, and when I was thinking of how to kind of look after the people that would be sleeping rough, it just came to me, the bikes, just in a flash or something, and then who would do it? And I said, no better than the lads, because they're a great sense of fun no matter what. And I know they would lighten the spirit for anybody, because some nights we'd be out and the laughter was unreal, but we had tears as well. So it was the recovery group did all of this, and what a job, you know. And like, I'd say they're only waiting up for the next crisis, because they want to know what they'll be doing. They'll probably be looking for mopeds or something. But
I think that point in time was captured brilliantly by Daniel Corcoran of Rollover Films. Can you remember we done that? He just shows the Cork City in complete lockdown, and like what we forget about is people that are linked in with charities like yourselves, key workers, support workers. Everybody was gone home. People still needed the support, and his videography showed a completely silent city and me narrating on it, and then it comes to the boys on the bikes with the smiles and the dinners. And I suppose that was poignant as well for me, in terms of I was working with on a team kind of collaboration between the Cork ETB, the Drugs Task Force, HSC, City Council. There was about 6 or 7 of us there. Any homeless person that had symptoms, they'd need to isolate, so we were coordinating the isolation, putting them into B&Bs. If the B&B couldn't provide a dinner, we'd contact yourselves. The boys then were bringing the dinners up to them, and we were just trying to make it as comfortable as we could, so that they could isolate. And there was, some of them had success stories out of it. We were able to place people in better places afterwards than before they came in. You know, so like, There was a lot happened over the lockdown. It was a huge effort.
Even going to the, you know, to the hotels now and the B&Bs with the food, and we went to a huge amount of vulnerable people. And we had one guard that used to go to a man whose daughter lived in Holland, and she couldn't get she couldn't come home over the virus, and she was worried about her dad. So she contacted my sister, who contacted me, and we said, okay, we'll check in on him. And the guard used to go, Ken used to go with a hamper to him, and then Ken would get the daughter on the phone, and he used to watch the dad, like, you know, he was in his 80s talking to the daughter in Holland. But there was a load of those stories, and like, the lads were doing it, and they were giving people the phone if they needed to ring somebody. Like, there was no ending to what the lads did, and they left no stone unturned. But going to the B&Bs and going to the hotels was very sad, because people and children would be sitting on the steps, you know, on the stairs when we'd be coming, and the lads would come back and they would be very affected by it. They said, that looks awful. And I said, no, it looks wrong. It shouldn't be happening. And it should never have happened. It should not have happened at all. And this is one thing I would urge the government to strongly think of, that when you put somebody someplace, feed them. Don't have them waiting and depending on somebody to come along to feed them. They should put that, have put that in place, because to see the children sitting on the steps or standing outside hotels or standing outside B&Bs for when we'd come along with the dinners, that was very sad to look at and very, very wrong. And it did affect, you know, the lads. I suppose we're used to seeing things in penny dinners, but the lads, even though some of them would have said we'd have been like that at one time, when they saw it in a different light, and from the light that they saw it from, they wanted to do more. And you could see them chatting. And with the meetings and penny dinners, we run meetings twice a week. And it was Connor, Tommy and Alan started the meetings inside. And they're very successful now. And again, like saying I'm very proud of them is kind of not even doing them justice. But what I'm proud of is the fact that they realise like that everybody needs some bit of help, and that they're able to give help now, and they're able to pull people along. And I've seen them pull loads of people along. Or they'd come up and they'd say, waste of time. And I'd be saying, stay at it for another little while. And they would, and it would happen. But it's, again, the government should be looking, I suppose, at what we do. We have plenty of solutions. This talking about the doom and gloom with the government is useless, because they know it. And they have letters morning, noon and night from everybody about the doom and gloom that's in this country. And when I say that, it's just the hardship, the pain that many families are affected by. And of course, they might email the government or write to their local TD or whatever. So the government are well aware. But what they're not tapping into is the likes of us at penny dinners who have solutions that will work.
I understand that completely, yeah. You know, but in previous times where I'd be in prison and in treatment centres, I always viewed that as respite.
Yeah.
Like, there was times where prison saved me from death.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? I'd be so bad, I'd go into court, the judge give me 6 months or 10 months or whatever. It's 2 months sometimes. It would just be enough time to regenerate.
Mm-hmm.
But it was always seen as respite to get out and use again. This time was different. This wasn't respite for me. It was like rebirth.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, you're going to become a different person here, James. You're going to give it your all. And, you know, after the detox, the 8-week detox, you're going to the residential treatment, which is just, it's in the same facility, you know, across the car park, like 16 weeks in there. Bearing in mind now to me where we're from, the facade, you know, the
grandos.
Yeah, perhaps. Like you've a wall in front of you. There's no emotions being shown. You deal with any disrespect or any adversity with confrontation, you know. And the same thing is in prison. It's the same bullshit. You know, so like you have to kind of leave off the impression that you're a hard man and you're this and that and the other. You know, prison and the street is the same. And that's why I found it so easy. In both areas, it was the same front. I went into the treatment centre with all them street behaviours, street attitudes, street mentality. And I tell you now, I found it so difficult, because I don't know if you, in the treatment centres you were in, but ratting is a big thing, you know. So like if you see me slipping back into all behaviours, you'll tell my counsellor and then he can flag it with me. So we don't slip. But like, to me, that's like, one of the number one things you don't do up around here is ratting somebody, you know what I mean? But all that street mentality, you know, dealing with people that I didn't really get on with in treatment, and just, you know, anger issues with frustration and comfort, all these things, like, you know, was jeopardizing my chance to stay there. Because, like, when you're in the real world, you can't be dealing with people that you don't get on with like that, with for confrontation and anger and all this. So I had to do anger management up there, and I had to do all these things, and, you know, cognitive behavioural therapy, change my thought patterns, look at my core beliefs.
It sounds to me that you had an awful lot of awareness. You were able to grasp these things initially, you know, which is fantastic, you know. It just shows how much you wanted to get well, you know.
But I remember I was in the residential gaff about 6 weeks, right? I didn't open my mouth now in the groups and the sessions and stuff, because I felt if I didn't say anything, he'd skip by me, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know the feeling.
Yeah. So he says to me after about 5 or 6 weeks, he He says, James, he says, you're around here. He says, you're walking, you're doing your thing, no trouble. You shouldn't be here at all. Mm-hmm. You've no issues. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with you. What are you doing here? And it was just about not leaving myself vulnerable in front of the group. I just found it so hard. He come to me, how are you doing, James? I'm grand, I'm fine. And I got away with that for about a month or 6 weeks. But eventually they got stuck on me, do you know what I mean? And it was just about leaving yourself vulnerable in front of a group. Do you know, I had a big issue with that. Like, where we're from to me, it's not safe to do that. Like, leave yourself vulnerable in front of a group and you may forget about it because that's weakness.
Or else you
could be used against you.
Yes, and you might be hurt even more.
Yeah.
You know?
But if you don't, like he used to say to me, leaving yourself vulnerable in front of people you know in a controlled group with therapists is a safe place to do. He says it's a risk, but it's a healthy risk. And, you know, healthy risk taking has been a fact of life since, you know what I mean? And by leaving yourself vulnerable in front of people, talking about some issues that you have going on for you, it just helped me to open up more, became more open with the counsellor and, you know, it just really helped me. It was a very hard thing for me to do initially. Once I learned to trust people that if I say stuff about, like if I lose the facade, and leave myself vulnerable, I'm not going to regret it.
Yeah.
I'm going to be accepted for who I am and there's going to be no judgment and no shame. And it doesn't matter what I've done or who I am. I was going to be met every day by the counsellor, unconditional, positive regard. Like they didn't care what I'd done. They just wanted to help me.
I think you're ready for a treatment centre. And that was when I picked up the phone and rang Table Lodge. And I got an appointment for an assessment. I went down there, done the assessment. Again, a staff member from Cork Lines came down with me. I really needed that support, you know, along the way. I didn't have any family around me. I had nobody literally around me at this point. Went down, done the assessment, and I remember at the time, 50 Cent was after coming. He was coming to Cork, and I was after getting a ticket for him. And I was after being given the date, but it was clashing with my concert for 50 Cent. So that wasn't going down too well at all with me, like. Yeah. So I was saying, look, if I have 50 Cent, the concert is coming up. If I come in now, well, the date that they were giving me, will you let me out then for the night for 50 Cent? I'll come back after the concert is over. And they were looking at me, stupid Phil, the woman that was there at the time.
Yeah.
She was like, you can't do that. We can't. I was like, but you can test me. You can test my earrings. And they were like, no, you can't do that. I was like, look, well, we'll put the bed on hold so on until 50 Cent is over and I'll come back. That was on a Friday. That assessment took place. On the Monday, I was on the phone begging them for my bed. I remember Phil saying to me, she's long gone now at this stage, but I remember Phil saying to me, but what about this 50 Cent fella? Do you know, I was like, I actually don't care about him. Right. I need the bed. Yeah. So I got in there, and while I was there, the concert was on and all of this stuff. And I'm so glad that I made, that I had, first of all, that I had that experience over the weekend, because it was an off weekend I was after having. That again brought me to the place where I was, you're right, you're going to do something here, you're going to die. This is the reality of it, like.
And you know what? It's a good point because we get a lot of people contacting us. Yeah. They want help. So we're not therapists. Yeah. We can only tell them what we did and see if that works for them. But sometimes people want the recovery. We say, look, my life is unmanageable. I'm full of addiction. My wife is throwing me out. My kids, blah, blah, blah. I need help. And we say, do you know what? Try residential treatment. Oh, I tried it before. It's not for me. If you want recovery, you'll make the sacrifices and you'll just fucking do
get rid of
the excuses. Yeah. If you have to get rid of the excuses, whether it be 50 Cent, that's just another example. You know, you have to get rid of the excuses. Yeah. Recovery has to be the number one thing. Because without recovery, nothing else is possible.
Yeah. And I remember when the day came for me to go into Table Lodge, like I was literally skipping down the road because I just see it. At that point, it was like, this is my way out. This is my chance. This is my way out. I could see that there was some bit of hope there. And but I remember going in there and like full affair.
But you were at the end. Like the reason I know you were at the end, like towards the end of James's addiction, yours, mine, it was all about suicide.
Oh, it is. That's where it all ends up.
And listen, James, we don't say this to scare anybody, any family member to have a family member in addiction that are completely destroyed and they don't know what to do. We don't say this to frighten them that that's coming down the line or anything like that. We're only speaking about our own experiences, which are quite similar. And mine was the same. I remember walking out of court and wanting to just walk over and jump into the river. You know, every time I used at that stage, I didn't want to wake up and I was taking large quantities of drugs. So, and passing out. And, you know, that's how it was, you know. And fortunately, I went down your route as well. I went to the doctor. I asked the doctor for, I told him I wasn't well. And he put me on meds. And he also got me to see a counsellor. And from there on, I managed to get myself into Table Lodge as well. I hadn't the foggiest clue what was going on. I thought I was going in there and I was going to be coming out and I could go home and I could go out on the weekend with my wife and go home and have a drink. Normal. Things changed in there. My life just changed. I had no awareness still. I hadn't a clue what they were talking about because intellectually I wasn't able to understand a lot of the stuff they were talking about.
But even
when
you're down there, like, they're talking, like, I remember being down, and I don't mean to call you down to me, but I remember being down there, it was like a nursery. That's the only way I can describe it, because we were like a lot of children running around the place.
But that's,
do you know what I mean?
Do you know what? That makes a lot of sense.
It was actually like a nursery, a preschool. We were all running around the place. We had no clue what was going on around us, and we were all half mad. From
makes
the
addiction.
Sense. We were mental, like.
It makes a lot of sense, because what this is what I've heard and read, is when people do stop drinking, they go back to the age that they started, you know. And so it makes a lot of sense when you think like that, because the mind is gone as well. The mind is racing at that time.
People that are in the cycle of addiction in prison, they don't mature mentally at all. Like, I was a teenager from the age of 15 to 28. It was only when I was 28 when I come out of treatment to start doing a bit of personal development. But then I kind of grew up, you know, and matured.
I'm the exact same. I think I might have even broke 7 or 8 because it was that young, that stuff, you know. I always felt like it was the child in a conversation. Like, I could be talking to, even when I was in prison, I would walk around the yard and I was talking to the lads, and I felt so inferior, you know, if that's the right word. You know, it was like, I didn't even know what to say. I didn't even know how I could even put a sentence together. Constantly.
Yeah, I can relate to that. And I struggled with a lot of that as well, especially early recovery. That would have, you know, I would have battled with a lot of that kind of stuff. But I suppose just to kind of fast forward a bit.
Did you do aftercare?
I went into Table Lodge. I was also treated at that point as well for an eating disorder, so I was in there for like 5 weeks or something. And then I came out, and
can you touch off that a small bit there, the eating disorder, if you'd like that?
The eating disorder, I suppose that was always, I'm just mindful of the time now as well.
No, you're fine.
Am I okay with the time? The eating disorder, I suppose that would have always been there on some level, body dysmorphia as well. I suppose when I was very young, I was very thin, like, there was no saying I wasn't. And I used to be looking at other people and I used to be thinking, oh, I need to put on weight, even though I couldn't put on weight. So then I'd start wearing pants underneath my jeans to make me look like I had more weight on my legs. And it was just all of that kind of stuff. And I know there's probably a lot of females out there can relate to that on some level. But with the eating disorder then, I would binge. I would restrict, I would binge, compulsively overeat, purge.
Yeah.
That was all going on.
Bulimia. Yeah.
Yes, bulimia. It was bulimia. And I know you had somebody on recently as well, Lorna, who spoke very well. I really enjoyed her podcast. I could relate to a lot of things. Situations different, but it's a disease, really. And I was that person that thought the doctor was jealous of me, because the doctor was telling me I was, you're on the weight, you're seriously on the weight. But I had it in my head. I just kept going, kept exercising, kept restriction. And in the meantime, in the middle of UCC, with all of this as well going on. Do you know what I mean? Like, there was, that part of it was really difficult. That part of my disease, the eating disorder, was really difficult.
Is that something that followed you in early recovery when you got out?
Yes, it did. It did follow me in early recovery. I was consumed with myself. I was consumed with how I looked and how I thought people saw me. And And today, none of that matters, what people think, really. Mm.
It's just a feeling of inferiority, yes. Like what Timmy spoke
yeah.
about.
Yeah.
How does that impact as a developmental trauma? In what ways does that evolve?
Well, it creates... I would say that what happens is that, and of course, sometimes that's transgenerational, that people are bringing it together. So that actually gets us to think about what do we mean by trauma?
Mm.
And that's a very important question. And Bessel, your friend that we spoke about, Bessel van der Kolk, Bessel would say trauma is not what happened in the past. It's what continues to be living in us, and we're living as if the past is still in the present.
Yeah.
So I would say that the question you're asking is so vital. How do the circumstances around us generate trauma?
Mm.
So the circumstances around us generate trauma in this way, that in the normal course of dealing with challenges, so challenges like we mentioned, conflict, domestic abuse, alcohol, substance abuse, all the things that fall out of that, poverty, and all the things that go along with that, overcrowding, sexual abuse, and, you know, but not just those things, but also what we would say, things that people need but didn't yet. Unmet needs. So a baby that was born but somehow wasn't reached. There wasn't somebody there to be able to mirror and
comfort
and support and nurture and all of that. When this happens, it overloads the system.
Mm.
We're not able to digest it. It's too much. And what happens then is that our system sets up a defense. And the first defense it sets up is what's often talked about as fight and flight.
Mm-hmm.
We charge up and we either want to escape or we want to fight back.
Mm.
And I'm sure I don't have to say that if you travel around different parts of the city and other places, you will find, say, teenagers, and they might have hoods up, and these are little babies inside, but you'd swear they were going to kill you.
The demeanor that they have is very angry.
Because they have anger and they have fear, and the two are running hot together. And you have them inside in schools, and teachers know this well, and I would be working sometimes with people from schools and, you know, helping them along with stuff. And the teacher would look at them and say, "Have you got your homework done?" "No, why?" "Don't you talk to me like that." And then you have...
It's just a trauma response.
The trauma response is kindled and is ready to go. Mm. You get out. And then they're outside and they're gunning for the teacher because the whole thing, their energy is up.
Yeah.
That fight and flight response is ready on the go if it's cultivated in their earlier life.
You know... wanted, you know, and I remember I was like living feral in Hyde Park. Everyone was like looking for me, and I was sleeping rough and eating out of bins in the park, thinking no one will find me here. And then two cops found me and brought me back to the hospital. Do you know what I mean? But it took years of kind of therapy and treatment and getting the right support.
How did you end up in the psychiatric hospitals in England? What happened there?
Oh, I had a breakdown, didn't I? I ended up
losing it.
Oh, fuck yeah, like. Yeah. Proper snapped one night, and I thought, fuck it, I'm going to end my life. That's it, I'm gone. So I thought I'd climb a bridge in London, and I went up and climbed the bridge, and it was one of the main transport links into central London, so I shut down pretty much half of that transport network for the greater London area. Ended up with a 4-hour standoff with the Metropolitan Police. They thought it was like some sort of, you know, initially I think they thought it was an attack, and then they didn't, and then I was like, Jesus, just, and then cops be shouting, fucking jump, and like all that stuff, and then the negotiator was there, and I just had a complete breakdown. And it was just because I couldn't
handle the emotions.
Didn't love myself, hated everything about me. I just wanted to escape from the reality that I was living in. And then the fella that got me off the streets in Dublin, he gave me a job working in London. That's how I ended up over there.
Do you know, you were actually dealing with all that shit, right? Without a substance or alcohol in your life. Like, that's what we would have used, and a lot of other people would have used substances and alcohol, do you know, to block out all that.
I would have drank a bit, but I wouldn't have been like...
There was no chronic addiction, like...
No, yeah. I wouldn't have to wake up in the morning and have to do a bottle of wine just to get the DTs away or anything like that. Very much kind of... I was a bit like a really mad roller coaster. There were days where I was just so happy and hyper, and everything's fine, and nothing's gonna happen, and you know, praise Jesus, all this shit, right? And the next day I'd be like, down there, but fuck everybody, fuck you, fuck it, fuck it, fuck it. And I'd be like, proper, just so angry.
Yeah.
And then eventually, when I got in the hospital, they explained that actually makes perfect sense. You've actually got bipolar. They diagnosed me that and they put me on loads of meds, which didn't agree with me like at all, because like some of the medication that I was on made me more chaotic and more just mad.
Can you tell us just briefly a little bit about bipolar disorder, what that actually is, the symptoms?
It affects everybody differently, do you know what I mean? For me, it's where I get kind of periods of mania to the point where I feel like I'm bulletproof, you know, like I'm just like, chest down, I'm like, that's deadly. Do you know what I mean? And it's like proper. And then you're like, boom, right down. It's almost like having the fear. You know when you've had a rake of drink at the weekend or something, when you wake up on the Sunday morning, you're like, geez, I can't remember ranting. Did I kiss your one in the office? Like, you know, you're proper panicking if you did something. And it's a bit like that for me anyway. And it was just like, that's what they diagnosed you with in the hospital, bipolar, PTSD, and emotionally unstable personality disorder. That's what they were, the labels that they gave me when I was in the psychiatric care in the UK.
Did the medication help you at all?
Yeah.
Are you on medication today?
I
worked with somebody and he had bipolar disorder, but it was diagnosed, you know, when he was in his 40s, like, but the medication changed his life, you know?
Saved my life, because I was able to then manage it. So then I ended up on a really high dose, and now I'm on quite a low dose, and I just manage that daily. And I still do a bit of talk and therapy.
For people, you had people who... like in terms of students in universities, there's a lot more diversity now as well, because there's a lot more, I suppose people have started to realise that people learn in different ways. So you would have a lot of students who would be on the autistic spectrum disorder, and some of them, it actually, they enjoyed, they much preferred the online learning because it was less social part of it. So they found it a little bit easier. There are students from low income families who need to work. They need to work to put themselves through education. So the fact that all the lectures were recorded, it meant that they were able to watch lectures at times that fitted in with their lives. You have parents who are parenting alone, who are students, who have small children. So when their children were gone to bed at nighttime, they could catch up on their lectures and they weren't under pressure to be in university at 11 o'clock. And I suppose for them, it made it more equitable. Because if you were parenting alone and you can't make your lecture at 11 o'clock because one of your kids, anyone who's had small children will know kids are constantly sick, they take turns at getting sick. You know, so you're thinking, oh, everyone else is in class now and they're all at the lecture and I'm missing it. And if you're coming from a place where you might be parenting alone, for example, you feel that extra pressure to be really, really good. So you feel like you have to, you know, maybe in a way that other people might be happy to miss the odd lecture because they're tired or they're not feeling well. Whereas you'll often find that students who have the biggest challenges actually push themselves harder and feel like they have to be better. So it made it more equitable because they're not sitting at home going, oh my God, there's, you know, 80 people in class and I'm missing out. I'm going to miss something. What am I missing? So it leveled the playing field for some people. Then there were other people, yeah, where they found it really difficult. Mm. You know, they particularly young people, they missed out on experiences that you should be having when you're that age. You know, because I had them when I was that
college is
age.
Much more than learning in the lecture, isn't it? The informal piece before that, the experience of being on campus and the library.
For some
the
young
student
people,
center.
It might be their first time living away from home as well, and that being able to put your hair down and do things that you wouldn't want your parents to know about, which are all very important parts of growing up as well. So that bit is missed out. The one thing I think that stood out to me is, like when lockdown hit, I was we've a master's in applied psychology, and there was a group of students on that master's, and I'm one of the co-directors with Dr. Angela Veal, and I felt so sorry for them. You know, it's a 1 year course, it's a master's. A big part of the master's is placement, and they were taken off their placement, and it's a huge thing for their CVs. I mean, I was having sleepless nights about what that would mean for them and how quickly they bounced. But they were really disappointed, but how quickly they bounced back and how supportive they were of each other and looking out for opportunities for each other. Oh, have you seen this? That'd suit you. That could be something you'd put on your CV. So there were lots of challenges. I think a lot of people in the last 12 months have, you know, some people, their mental health has been impacted. Some people have said actually that they needed to step back and that actually their mental health improved. So I don't think it's been the same for everybody. I think I'm saying this because I worked there, but I you know, you possibly there's a bias, but I felt myself that UCC very quickly put on a lot of supports and services for students. I suppose I can only talk about my own department in applied psychology. I know that my colleagues in applied psychology went above and beyond, and we were always on the, students would email us and they'd say they were struggling, and then we'd ring them and see what had to be done to put in place in order to support them. When you go to, for our students in applied psychology, we want our students to get the best grades that they can get for them. No, we don't want students to be coming in and failing, and we want them to achieve their potential. You know, I suppose I just know, you know, in our own department, my colleagues, how hard they worked to try and make sure that everybody was looked
What's
after.
What's your thoughts on the students got a big, they got a lot of bad press about this pop payment. Like, there was a lot of media coverage around or the students that would have been working part-time and getting €150 and now getting €300 on the pop. And there was this idea that students were fucking raking in the coin because of COVID, you know what I mean?
But yeah, so it's not true.
Yeah.
So if you were earning €150, you did not get a full pop payment. If you were earning €150, you got €150. University is much more diverse now, and actually in terms of the pop payment, there's only a very small percentage of people on the pop payment that are actually students. I have students who are mature students. They do not live at home, they have been living independently for a long time. They work full-time jobs down on top of their full-time education. They get up at 6 o'clock in the morning and they stack shelves. They come into college and then they go home and they go out and they deliver pizza. And they do that to put themselves through university. COVID shut down their work, but their university still kept going. So they absolutely deserve money in the same way as anybody else who lost their employment. An awful lot of students now have to work in order to pay rent, have to work in order to pay fees. And they do that and they balance their college life as well. I think it's very unfair, some of the commentary that's gone on around young people. Just because you're 23 doesn't mean that you don't have outgoings in the same way as I do when I'm 45. People are entitled to social welfare. You're entitled to it. And you can't discriminate against one group just because of their age or because of the fact that they don't have a voice.
Yeah. That's true, like, isn't it?
But a very small percentage, a very small percentage of people on pop are students.
If they kept my cell, I would have went back, but they didn't. And then I said, I'd stay, then drawn everything back over, going to a different land and then this and that. So then I stayed, and so then a month later, my mother committed suicide,
What was that like for you that time?
It was tough, James, boy.
Were you strung out at that time?
I wasn't strung out. I wasn't strung out, but I was dipping and dabbling, you know. I never forget it, boy. I never forget it enough, so this is where my head was. I had an officer open my cell and says, what time has come out there? The chief wants you. I says, Tom, I'm getting the job that I was looking for. And he goes, come off to Timmy's cell. And I walked over him and I opened the door. I seen him in tatters crying. And I just goes, I kind of knew straight away, James. And I, whoa. And they said, stay there. And I says, no, I'll go back to my own cell, draw. And I did, but it was tough. I went off the rails and I says, Dave. And then, you know, we got down to the funeral and seen my man for a few hours. We didn't get to the funeral to see her lay at the rest. And when I got back, but I was there saying, they wouldn't do that for me, no, I'm doing nothing for them. Mm. You know, and then I just went head for leather on drugs, you know. I was badly strung out in there. Mm. I was heavily, you know, I was up to everything.
Do you know, when at that time, Timmy, you're grieving for your mum inside, are you worried about your brother then as well? Like, are you detached from it, or how are you?
I was dealing with my own stuff, you know, because I had a lot of regret as well, because myself and my mother didn't have too much of a relationship at the time, and I was fortunate that the night before she took her life, it was her birthday. It was her birthday on the 2nd, and she took her life on the 3rd. And she'd rang Tommy, and Tommy was talking to her inside in the class office on the landing. And I was just mattered to be passing the landing at that stage. And Tommy calls me, he says, my mum's on the phone, I go over and say hello to her. You know, my mum, I see what was after happening was my mum was, me and my mum, we were going through our own stuff, you know. And she said she was seeing a counsellor, and I was seeing a counsellor as well, and I was dealing with a lot of different issues, you know, and I wasn't in a great place, to be honest with you, you know. And I spoke to her on the phone, and you know, I said, ma'am, how are you getting on? And getting emotional.
Yeah.
Mm.
Take your time.
Right, I says, how are you getting on? She says, I've seen the counsellor. And that was a big deal for me.
Yeah.
You know, but
you were both on your healing journeys, like.
Yeah.
But I didn't.
Throw us over the box of tissues there, Sean.
I didn't. Sorry, lads.
Oh, boy.
Find them.
I didn't realise that it was going to be the fucking last day with a hero, you know. But because of the guilt and stuff I had from not having a relationship with her at the time, I wasn't able for it because I was in a bad way. But my own mental health, I was destroyed, you know. But
at least you got to say hi to her.
It was good to have him on the landing, you know. Even though he was breaking my heart half of the time, I was running around the landing, like, trying to chase him to get him up to AA and fucking to get him up to the school, to get him off the landings and stuff, you know. It was a difficult process, you know. But, like, everybody loved him. I knew there was never going to fucking be anybody go near him or anything like that, but he was loved, you know. He got on with everybody, and we were on a really, it was a mad landing, how we got it. But we got on with all the lads. I was doing my own thing, you know. And there was one thing that always kind of always stood to me, and it was told to me inside me before I went into prison. And it was like, Timmy, just always remember one thing. And they said, people, places, and things, you know. And I didn't understand what that meant, people, places, and things. And they said to me, like, people, stay away from people from your past. Stay away from people who are caught up in addiction and stuff like that. You know, places, stay away from pubs, you know, and things, stay away from things that will get you back into the same kind of bother, you know, behaviours and stuff. And that's what I lived by. Every single day I'd say, people, places, things, people, places, things. And, like, for me, that was a big deal because, like, I had Tommy 3 cells down on the landing for me, and it was like I had to stay away from my own brother because of him dealing with his own shit. No, in addiction, and it was difficult, and it was a lonely, lonely fucking place, to be honest with you, but it was the best place for me at the time, you know, and even for him, you know, like, I was offered an open prison after fucking 12 months or whatever, and I declined because I needed to be there, because I was getting a lot of help off the psychologist on the prison, the counselling. I was doing my junior cert in the school, a lot of personal development groups, you know, and I was in the right place at that time, you know, but it was tough for me. It was tough on the landing, you know, and then John Paul came up. John Paul, the three of us were on the same landing then, you know, but I kind of kept my distance from the boys. I knew what was going on, but I didn't want to be in their faces fucking giving them shit, you know what I mean?
Well, the people, places and things, like, just happened to be your family members were some of the people that were the trigger in your life. And that's a lot of people that be listening and watching can relate with that.
Yeah.
How do you, like, people, place and things, relapse prevention, that's the basics of it. But it's very hard when it's your family is the people and your house might be the place. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's very difficult.
And that happens a lot.
But, you know, it was tough. It was tough. Like, as because you're a cleaner then on the landing, you know, and I was a cleaner and I wasn't using drugs, right? But a fella might call and slip something underneath the door and tell you to drop it to another cell. And he's like, fuck, hell, that's completely against. But if you don't do that, then like, you'll be getting yourself into trouble in the cell, in the prison. So, you know, there was things like that, you know, but I just done what I had to do, you know what I mean? And get through it, like, and...
So, do you know, things, obviously, your mother passed away, you're in and out of prison, the addiction is getting worse. How did you manage to get into recovery?
Do you know, like, it was all around me, James. It was all around me. My family, my friends, everyone. I was like a lone soldier by on my own, you know, isolated, everything. And it was just hitting rock bottom, James, but hitting rock bottom. Things were, I'll never forget it, but it was around the Christmas, yeah? And me and another fella, we were staying in the Orange, yeah? As you get, go in the gates there, there's a little, like a security hut, but it's an old, old building.
Yeah.
So we were in there, and around the Christmas by, and in tatters. I remember, as you know me, I'd always have me good clothes on for Christmas Day and what have you. But I was in there, nowhere to go, after pushing everyone around me that loved me away. Pushed them all away, but they couldn't deal with me no more. And I remember being in there, boy, and I never in my life felt so lonely. So lonely, boy, I just wanted to die. And that's where it comes to with the needles. So I remember taking a few tablets, and a lot of fellas would have dread of him. And I tell them, put it in, wanting to go over, wanting to die. That's where it was. And I remember when he put it into my hand and he was, no, I'd be fucking killed. No, fucking do it. And he done it and I'm there like that. Am I going over now? Yeah. Will I go over now? Nothing happened. And another fella came up and I got him to do the exact same. That was two of my first times, right? Do it. Nothing happened. And then I done it once or twice after that. Similar things, wanting to go over, wanting to die. And I had enough, boy. I couldn't keep on. And I couldn't take my own life because I was afraid of it. I prayed not to wake up the next morning, I don't know how many nights, praying to go to sleep and die. And it was game over. And I was in Arbor House, I was on methadone, and I went from Arbor House to Blackpool, and then I went from Blackpool to George O'Mahony's surgery, and I had a doctor up there, and I says, look, I want to get into treatment. Give me your lines. I'll ring them with you. Rang Francis Pham, and rang her with me, give me four your lines, and we'll have you in as soon as. I actually done it that time. I'd done it by previous, before that, I tried to get in there as well, James. And I'd done the O-rings, done everything. They rang me and said, you're going in Sunday. I couldn't handle it, James. Mm. What was the first thing I went to? I went away and mused and rang on back. I'm after using. I couldn't. Mm. Oh, I couldn't. I wasn't ready. I says, but I didn't use heroin and after taking tablets. We'll have to put you back for 2 weeks. That was back then. But that went on for a year and a half on then, and then all the Christmas stuff came up and draw. So it was after that I said, that's it, it came over.
Mm. I remember you rang me a few days before you was out to go in.
Mm-hmm.
And if you'd asked me straight up would I have believed you would have sustained it, no.
Mm.
Because of you had the opportunity before and you didn't take it.
Yeah.
And it was like, are you going to self-sabotage yourself? Are you going to, you have an opportunity here now, are you going to use or?
I'd tell you now how hard it was.
Took your chance.
How hard it was for me to get into treatment. I couldn't get a day clean, James. I could not get a day clean. You know yourself, you've been there, especially around heroin. And I could not get a day clean. And I was given bogey orange, you know. That's the only way, and I was drawn the way you'd be very clever mm-hmm. in ways to get around things on heroin. You'd be professional. Yeah. So I bought myself a mug, the coffee mugs, and I'd have it with pipe and water. So by the time I get from Nahini down, I'd have the piss inside in that.
Keep it warm.
Keep it warm, yeah. And I'd go down. And just before I go in, I'd be taking out the urine. I'm sure there was time she was burning my hands and all by taking the urine. It was that hot. So it was
a bottle of tea.
And I kind of think she knew I needed it, but I just could not get clean by and I remember giving the phone and she goes, congratulations. Mm. Congratulations. We'll give him that now and we'll get the thing. And I used up to the minute, James. Used heroin up to the minute that I knew I got the phone call that I had a week
to get it out of your
system. To get it out of my system. And what I had to do was get tablets for the whole week. I was on my own medication to go in there, but I just bought every tablet I could to take me away from the heroin.
Yeah.
And I remember I was so out of it all week that no one thought I was going to make it. No one thought I was going to go. I'm out of my head now, round the place, getting arrested the night before I went in. I remember going into the gas station after doing something in town and getting arrested. And they brought me up and saying, please don't lock me up. I'm going to treatment in the morning. They were probably saying, you heard this fella? You're out of his fucking head.
Mm-hmm.
But they left me out. And one of our friends, Sean, I was outside Sean's at 7 o'clock the next morning, out of me natural mind on tablets. Out of it. And he goes, Tommy, but God, loom. You all right? I was on death's door. He goes, am I wasting my time going up here? I says, I'm telling you now, there's no heroin in me. It's all tablets.
Everything else but it.
Everything else but. And he goes, right, come on. I went into the back of his car, but I was in the back, curled up in the back seat. And up the road.
That was the start of it.
That was the start of it, boy. That was the start of it.
So it's called living on the streets, yeah? Bear with me now, no pressure.
Living on the streets, night and day. He sees them, but they don't see him. And maybe it's the way through poverty, fighting back his hunger and his pain. While he sits there listening to the morning rain,
as it ricochets off shop window panes. People passing by, heads held high. They'll stop, look, and they'll stare with no worries, not a care. And night time closes in, and again he cannot win. Tomorrow may be a better day. Living on the streets is no price to pay. He still bears the pain of his old man's ways. His mother rest her soul. He's here but alone. And now he calls the Dublin streets his home. And is he just a man without a name, living on the streets without a tiger's claim? In my time here again, tomorrow maybe then, it may be a better day. Living on the streets is no price to pay.
Well, the boss. Yeah, that's
Paddy.
Living on the streets anyway, yeah.
Run, Paddy. I was thinking of Damien Dempsey.
Yeah, the hand was locking up there. I'm still a novice when it comes to, like, you know, performing in front of
you. You actually, for somebody that's playing the guitar for the length of time you are, you're actually very, very good, yeah. And you have a very, very, very good voice.
Yeah. I appreciate it. A lot of people have been saying, Paddy, keep it up. You're very good. But you know when you hear yourself back, like, I'm sure. Yeah. You know when you first set up as a podcast and like. We really sound like
cringing.
That. Yeah, do we really fucking sound like that? But no, much appreciated, much appreciated.
But you know what? We were on the Late Late Show a couple of weeks ago, mm-hmm. And we'd fun, you know, we were relaxed and we were confident. But a couple of years ago when we started out, it would have been way different. But just a bit of self acceptance, thinking, you know what? I am who I am, fuck it, isn't it?
That's one thing I enjoy. There, a couple of months ago, there was a talent show up in the church, and usually I'm just used to singing in front of 4 or 5 prisoners in the cell, but there was a whole bleeding group of prisoners up there, you know, and I sang 4 songs. I sang Ride On, a song that I wrote for my daughter called...
Christy Moore is a big Christy fan Moore, of the podcast. Ride On,
yeah, I love all his stuff. My dad loved him, he loved all that, loved him. So I sang that one, Living on the Streets, Yellow Feathered Birdie that I wrote for my daughter, Zombies, what was the other one I sang? What was the other one saying? Zombies, Yellow Feather Body, Ride On, and On the Streets. Yeah, them 4 songs. And after that, I didn't even know I was getting a standing ovation. Mm. But everyone was like, Paddy, I'm bleeding deadly. But, you know, I suppose every musician.
You wrote a song for your daughter?
Yeah, I wrote a song for my daughter called Yellow Feather Body. Yeah. Has it like a little whistle and all in it.
Look, do you want to sing it?
I've no plectrum.
Do you need a plectrum? Or is it a picking or.
No, there's no picking it.
Even a taster, if you had a taster of it.
A taster? Okay. So.
There's a yellow feather birdie that sings all night long. And he sits in the garden from dusk till dawn. Oh, I don't know where he's from, but it seems he has no home.
I can tuck you between my blanket for warmth. Because I know, oh I know, I know how it feels to be alone. Oh yellow feathered birdie, it's maybe here you belong. This yellow feathered birdie, he makes me feel young. And while we play in the garden, oh he'll chirp out a song. But it seems he has no one, no one else for his love song. Can you tuck me beneath your feathers, we'll go. We can sing some soothing songs, we can sing them all day long. Oh yellow feathered birdie, won't you sing me a song? There's a yellow feathered birdie that sings all night long. And he sits in the garden from dusk till dawn. Oh, I don't know where he's from, but it seems he has no home. I can tuck you between my blanket for warmth. Because I know, oh, I know, I know how it feels to be alone. Oh, yellow feathered birdie, it's maybe here you belong. This yellow feathered birdie, he makes me feel young. And while we play in the garden, oh, he'll chirp out a song. But it seems he has no one, no one else for his love song. Can you tuck me beneath your feathers, we'll go. We can sing some soothing songs, we can sing them all day long. Oh yellow feathered birdie, won't you sing me a song?
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.